Blog Talk Radio.
Found us again, Masonic Effects, or in a sense, it found you. How are you? Here, we're just right off the hop. We have some new contacts around the planet, and please don't. I can't begin there's no words for me to express the gratitude and a bit of amazement that Masonic Effects seems to have gained traction. Thank you for that. That's on you. It's on you, ladies and gentlemen. And I think it speaks to a theme that we're going to be working on over the next couple of weeks. We appear to be serving a need, which is very gratifying to be able to do that. I tend to think that by tuning in, you're declaring in a way that you are the kind of people that step up and I don't know whether it's simply volunteering or sacrificing, somewhere along that range. You're the kind of people that will do things because it's necessary. They're necessary. And the odd thing about sacrifice, it is odd, and you've been around long enough to know that you see the same fellows will step up, same few fellows. What is it? The 20-80 rule, is it? 20% of the people do 80% of the work, something along that. And they get great satisfaction out of it. Only when they look over their shoulder, they see that all the other people around benefit from their work. And rarely do you see anybody showing gratitude for that, right? That's the nature of us. You can look at these other people as if they are deficient. However, I might offer another speculation. I don't think they're deficient. I think these are people that don't share the sense of awareness that you have. We can look and say they ought to, but you and I, we know that the awareness is complicated, isn't it? It's complicated. And who's to say? Yeah, certainly. Are we expecting that awareness should happen when we're young, when we're in middle age? I've often thought that awareness, the finest answer, the most accurate answer and understanding comes in the last moments of our life, when we can look back at our entire life and the world that we've lived in, and then assess. I think it's important, ask the same question. If I ask you, in your 20s. Tell me what's important in life. You'll tell me. If I ask you 10 years later or 20 years later the exact same question, you'll tell me to the fullest of your intent, the fullest of your knowledge. And I think that if I ask you when you're very, very old, that there is that you will be able to tell me with the fullness of your experience the most honest, the most fulsome answer to the question. And what is it, one question or is there many? I think there's many questions. I live in a culture that is wrestling with the idea of dismissing our elderly people as having lived past their freshness date. That's because they can't be exploited for gain by owners. Huh? Their ability to produce and contribute has been in the past. Now, I know I've spoken to people that think of this group as freeloaders, although they sort of dismiss the fact that these are the folks that contributed all those taxes all those years, as if, contributing so that when our countries needed to build roads or infrastructure, it costs a tremendous amount of money. Well, you need a pool of money. Well, these folks or these folks over the course of their working time contributed to that pool of resource, and it was used. And we know that goes on and on and on. So do they deserve any kind? They're not going to get a premium for all of that investment. Their time and effort, their taxes, their contributions. But one way that we do here is by respecting it, that we wouldn't be where we are without all of those old folks and all of their that have reached the point of retiring. And when you, however young you are, whatever age you are, when you reach that point, you will have contributed to the generations that follow. Yeah, that's the way it is. You, in a way, it fits with that theme, that sense of sacrifice and duty. Knowing that not everybody can, you don't do it. You don't help somebody expecting everybody is going to do it unless the people perceive need. Huh? You notice when we see pictures of people from all walks of life digging in with sandbags and there's a flood coming. Everybody's pitching in. The people with that have well-prepared faces and manicured nails are pitching in because the need is so great. It's compelling. It's not like you can walk away because it's the need. It's the need. And if you're not able to perceive that for whatever reason, then you don't pitch in. You don't contribute. You don't see the work, the trigger for the work. We're not really that much different. We're not really that much different. Where need is, great things happen. Is there mistrust when somebody else is talking about the need or conjuring up every single moment of every single day? I have media that is trying to sell me a product. It's constant. The nice thing is I can tune it all out. They hinge it on the idea that I get something, give me some mediocre programming that's curated by, and in exchange, I listen to their sales pitch, their advertising. They're manipulating. It's really manipulation. That's all stuff that came out of after the First World War. Except, oh my goodness, I have an off switch. that's the joke. I can shut it off. And I do. You do. And when you look at the younger generations, they're bored to this. It's like this is mindless. Why would you listen to radio programs listen to me? I'm dating myself. Why would you listen to radio programs that are full of ads when you can just pick your own music with no ads? I'm such a product of my times. I was absolutely flabbergasted with this dilemma. I get to pick my own music. Well, what do I want? What do I like? When I tune in my CBC listen to my favorite, I think about my favorite programs over the years, and many of them are gone now. I think that it wasn't a question that I was going to negotiate what the topic was. It was like somebody is going to pick a topic that's going to be interesting to me. As it happens, one of the programs that I still listen to, and just for that, I'm back in the era of Barbara Fromm. You guys remember that? Wonderful interviewer, and that was a source of a connection for this little boy, way back at late at night when I could tune in a scratchy signal. From Texas or from Indiana, and all these ads that I never heard before. The infrared was new information, and the music was different. We didn't have that kind of music around where I was living, but in the morning that signal went dead. I never understood the physics of it all, but now. All of that mystery is I can still do that. I can still tune in a radio signal, and I do. I listen to the French channel on CBC. It's wonderful, and it helps me try on with my learning French. But I can tune out when it becomes bothersome, when there's no need that I can see. I tune it all out without grumbling. There's no weight on my shoulders. It's like it's a need. It's always present. It's ever present. So I think where Masonic Effect seems to be serving a need. And I just want to go over, if you don't mind, I'll go over the list. And I don't know you, but I know, you know, this system gives me a list of nations where listeners are tuning in. This is curious, and for what it's worth. I'll just go through the list very quickly here. South Sudan, there's a civil war going. Anyway, South Sudan, Oman, China, hello. New Zealand, always, always welcome. Been with us for a while. Ethiopia, Turkey, Latvia, Pakistan, Iran, Persia, USA, Ireland, yeah. The UK, yep. Canada. What a curious, curious cohort. Thank you. Thank you. I'm not going to be modeling about it. Thank you. Where I am, you may be able to cast some light on the subject. We're regaining our footing. We've been through a period where we're experiencing consequences that were anybody that was doing the math. There's no surprise. These consequences have been in play for decades. But there was no need to examine them. There was no need to examine the mathematics that was right there. And it was being reported. Every year we report such things annually. So that's not to say that and to me it's just elevating the importance of the craft and our grand lodges generally. If you were to say, you know, the success of the Louvre or the Hermitage or the Ashmolean Museum or the Met – it depends on the number of visitors. What about it? That would be one way of analyzing, and you need that. You need to, if you're paying for subscriptions, to pay for the lights and the security and the environmental controls. Yeah, you need to. It's a way of generating revenues. But to suggest that's all is is dismissive of the art, the artistry, the beauty that contained. Is a museum only necessary when it's enormously popular? Are the arts? It's a question that's been asked at different times. Well, not everybody appreciates the arts. So why are why are they subsidized? Why not just close the doors? Well, they define us. They define a culture. And our culture, like the craft, is not based on the lowest common denominator, but our best. Our best. Those overachievers. That notion of operating on the level. You didn't think it was the lowest common denominator, did you? Wherever did an idea like that come from? You didn't think it was competition. We're not in a scrum here. No. This is the influence of when you think about it. I remember years ago thinking, well, you know, I'm not really certain direction, career, all those types of things. But it occurred to me that while I was still sorting it out, I wasn't alone, that other people had been in this position at my age. I'm very positive, sure of that. And better to be around people that are achieving, that have drive, that have specificity in their learning. Better to be around that group of people because of the influence. Well, brethren, I think you and I are the influence. It isn't doing the least amount. No, that's not an influence. That's like we just have to move past that. It's the influence of effort and that the outcomes. You know, the person that you least expect that overcame some level of adversity. Well, most of us do. And if we start to look at this in terms of ethics, of course it's unfair. Of course it's unfair. Very few of us are born with that silver spoon in our mouth. And even the person that's born with a silver spoon in the mouth does not escape the trials and tribulations of real life. The angst, the depression, the anxieties, nobody escapes that. Nobody escapes that. Even the people that will pick up an opium pipe don't escape because it's withering. They become disconnected, they're emotionally remote, isolated. And it sucks the life out of them, not only the imagination, but it sucks the life out. And that's why there's no need for that in the world. You want to escape. Well, the best escape isn't the best escape success. You have a resentment. Let's say, I know it's only me. You have a resentment. There's something that's gnawing at you. Some unfairness has been visited to you. Isn't it very, very satisfying to think that the best revenge is success? The best, you know, to be able to achieve happiness when it's not expected. That's excellent. I'll share with you a little secret. If you have adversity in your life, you know that you've resolved it. The person knows when they've resolved it by experiencing this. When you can deal with the subject or the person or the situation as you will, we don't erase memory, but when you can deal with it with complete indifference, it is what it is. That's resolution. Moving on. It's not that you won't periodically have those bittersweet moments. Of course, that's the human condition. But moving on, indifference, yeah. that's something that you know, as I'm saying it, you'll know that, but apply it. Yeah, actually apply it. And think about it in your own being, and just think about the things that those adversities and you'll know your reaction And indifference is, it is, it is. Not good, not bad, just move on. It was. That's, and I'd like to think that Masonry offers us that in so many ways. The, you know, if you have a bit of a sense of humor, regardless of your position in life, imagine the surprise of people that underestimated you when you've worked very, very hard, not to prove to them or anybody else, but to yourself. Prove your capability to yourself. Oh, you and I see that all the time, people underestimating themselves. Be the influence. Be the influence. You can't proselytizing, oh my goodness, you just empty a room. If you remember fire, and if you don't follow this this belief and this faith, you're going to go to hell. You want to empty a room, just start proselytizing. There was a need not to alienate yourself before in small communities. So everybody went, everybody was devout. And it's important. It serves some very, very useful cultural needs. Today, not so much. Today, we've held out those beliefs and examined them for what they are. We've examined them through this lens of reason. Now, does reason erode faith? Well, I can't understand. I can't explain that one to you. But I do notice something. Notice that most of the very, very brilliant people in the world are people of faith. Now, I don't understand that. I didn't meet them. I know their work. But it tells me something. You know, it tells me something. It's like when Einstein was asked if he believed in God. He believed in the God of Spinoza. Huh? There we go. Now, who's it? What? Who's that? Well, take a look, because it does have a bearing on us. He came out after. Spinoza was around after the writings. But if you're looking to fill in the blank and ask some questions, if you have a need, you begin to ask why. In other words, you've become the philosopher. No, don't be silly about it. And no sense giggling. You are. That's all. That's all. And how far you take that, that's either depends on your mates or the time that you apply to it. My dear grandfather had time when he was working. He's a farmer and a mason. And he would work through these things, chattering away to himself, doing ritual, you know, teaching himself and refreshing ritual when he was working in the fields. He could talk to the animals. He had time and he used it. And he would recite to Robbie Burns. It's his secret, eh? Now mine. And I love that. I love that he had that side of his character that he developed. And what I love most of all, what I appreciate as I get older, is that he had no need to display it, no need to compete. He was, in many ways for me, that man who had found contentment. hard to believe, given the complexity of life for a farmer, what they have to do in order to be successful. And if there are any farmers out there listening, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm from a farm family, from generations. Anyway, the idea of finding the need. Some people, it's natural. They see a need in resolving suffering, medical school, eh? Or the sciences, or neurology, or biology, or just a need to contribute, whether it's genetic research and genetics, a need to contribute to the body of knowledge, knowing that somebody else will use it. Now, we have vaccines that are being produced. The idea behind them is just, I find that diabolical. Like, you thank you for sending your daughters and your sons to school. thank you for not having to holding off on buying a new house or holding off on buying new furniture to get the kids through. Your kids are genius. Look what they, and their kids have been genius. And look what they're producing now. Where do these ideas come from? And then, oh my goodness, we gave them access to computer technology. And what are they doing? AI. These are scary genius kids. And but do they need us? Absolutely. When you're having a discussion about the ethics of all of this, you're talking in the language of a Mason. Mm-hmm. How do you know it's the right thing to do? Just because you say so? Isn't that? Tell me, how did you distinguish the ethics of that from your will or from ego? Just help me with that. Those are things I have no idea. I can't see. Just the need. Oh, I think you'll find the program today follows that riff. I'm certainly going to work on that. I've sent out some stuff. If you guys are connected, and oh my goodness, don't ask me to defend the ethics of these providers. I do have Facebook and going on. I have no defense. They are. But if you want to connect, I do have a private group that I give you access. Just identify that you're a listener to Masonic Effects. And I don't want to give out any more than if the need is great, you'll find me. I'm accessible. The program today is I think informative. I hope it's stimulating, and I, if we're very fortunate, we're able to influence. But there's a need. The need to have this conversation with you that I feel is out there. And I wonder, years ago, many years, 11 years ago now, what happens to that one fellow in a lodge who wants to have this kind of conversation and there's nobody there? Or the person, for whatever reason, that's confined to a hospital bed and can't answer the summons. Okay, well, does he not have ideas, and does he not have worth anymore? And should we not extend, if we can, the conversation, the Masonic conversation, the brotherhood, the questions? Should we not be able to listen? Listen to him. Don't get me started, eh? Too late. Well, let's get on with the program today. The commentary. That's what I do like it. I do have to admit, it's a good one. And I'll catch you up, we'll hook up on the other side. This is Emmett Cohen Trio. He's doing something live at the Detroit Jazz Festival a couple of years, just before the outbreak of COVID. See what you think. That'll have to do for a start. Not bad. Perfect inclination. The phrase you might have heard a time or two. Damned interesting stuff, this masonry. It is a book cover so interesting, it is worthy of study by itself. With all the conditions and antecedents that were finally put in writing, early designers came to terms with cost benefit of writing for us. Something had to be sacrificed. So much had happened in the decades leading up to a legendary meeting of London lodges intent on giving us form. It raises a question. Are the philosophical and historical inferences of the 18th century still valid, still in play today? What we take for granted today was treated with suspicion by the estates. Rebellion was in the air. People in Britain and Europe were reaching the breaking point. Rebels told us they wanted stability, but stability that contained rights and protections so everyone knew where they stood. When men were fighting for rights, they were treated as life-death truths, worth dying to preserve. Are we living the consequences? It seems values come with a fresh by date, after which they need to be renewed. Another way of saying, is there a fresh by date for obligations? I think we can agree values are vital in our lodges, but how? How are values kept current? Masonry allows us to enlist all manner of sources, from arts and sciences to personal conduct and reputation. All it requires is a desire and enough curiosity to turn attention ever slightly. Being told by our guides the fishing is best at that time of day, on this section of the river. Since we each experience reality through a unique set of eyes, we might agree we can't know your misery, but we know our own. If they are a similar weight on the heart and mind, we understand human nature. If not, the transactions repeated through time then the mental experiences are always unique. We are fortunate, knowing the fates are in play, that unexpected things happen that test our convictions. But in the meantime, we can live well and be aware. Not too shoddy. That's the Humber Studio Jazz Ensemble. Some of you might know Humber College, the music program out down on the Lakeshore campus. Fabulous. Year by year, the quality of the music is just unbelievable. It's wonderful. And happy to say it's from our it's homegrown. It's homegrown. Here's something homegrown. The things that have been happening around the world have made me, as many of us, to stop and pause and think about whether we're progressing or not. And for that, I can listen to the investigative journalism that's going on. Some of it is just incredible, and some of it is selling cotton candy. But there's a lot of good information when you find a good source, a reliable source. I like to have information that challenges me. I don't like to be fed the same meal or somebody guessing, you know, what I want to hear. In fact, with the algorithms out there, much of the software is actually telling me what I ought to listen to, what I ought to read, what I ought to listen to and study. I have my own ideas on that. Thank you very much. And I kind of think that my own are more accurate than what an algorithm can come up with because, you know, quite frankly, my thinking is often quite lateral. I see something over here and it fits with something that the algorithm doesn't seem to keep up with. This is the kind of poet that I think, you'll see the connections, I think. This is the poet that is claimed to be the most closely associated with the 1930s. The war at end, all war, didn't bring about a peace that lasted. 1919, the settlement. If you've looked at Margaret Macmillan's work in 1919, Paris, 1919, you'll see how vulnerable and how frail were the people making those major decisions. And it became intolerable for the losers. Victors did not pay attention. And here we were in the 30s, ramping up with a great deal of concern and a pushback. This is not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And it did happen in a horrible way. A lesson learned by cutting deeply into the humanity. This fellow was a friend of W.H. Auden, the American poet that we've spoken about. They met, this fellow is named Stephen Spender, Sir Stephen Spender. They went on to become. They met at Oxford and they were part of a left-wing group of poets. And that also included Louis MacNeice and Cecil Day Lewis. And an association that gave rise to the nickname Bixbounde. But they were never a movement in any formal sense. And despite not finishing his degree, Stephen Spender's years at Oxford were formative, and not least in the lifelong friendship he developed with Auden. In 1929, Spender visited Germany with Christopher Isherwood. Can you imagine the arts were so advanced, the music, the sculpture, the poetry. Germany was a center, a cultural center. So a lot of very learned people would visit, of course. My, you know, just remarkable, remarkable. And he went with Christopher Isherwood. We'll talk about Isherwood at some other point. And in the early 30s, Spender went to Spain there was a tensions going on, and he joined the International Brigade in the fight against Franco, the dictator. Then Spender was very briefly a member of the Communist Party, which asked him to observe and report on the conflict. And that experience affected him greatly. He, in his early volumes of poetry, this is reflected, his commitment to the socialist cause. That, I think, is about, it's been bantered around and abused and to suit the purpose of whoever's speaking. But it, generally, the thinking here was this dichotomy. On one hand, you had the individualism, and the other, you had the common good, the greater good. Not with the sensationalism of politics, but just the idea. Do you help your neighbor or do you compete? That's breaking it down quite unfairly, I know. So he was writing about this cause, this common good. And he, in 1934, his poems were about protest, and they were personal and humanistic. Rather than deductive, they weren't there to teach. They're there to expose. You take away what you will. And they were informed. You can tell that they were informed by a deeply self-questioning mind. I love that notion, deeply self-questioning mind. And the other main strand of his work at the time were poems in praise of technological progress. The Pylons, and it was written as a deliberate challenge to the prevailing rural themes of English poetry. And then he became quite disenchanted with communism during the Second World War. 1949, year I was born, he was one of a group of intellectuals formerly sympathetic to communism, who contributed essays of disillusionment to the God that failed. Due to various physical problems, he wasn't able to fight in the war, but instead served in the London Auxiliary Fire Service. Ugh, can you imagine the horror? He co-founded with Cyril Connolly and Peter Watson Horizon magazine, and he was the editor from 39 to 41. And then his personal life shifted. At Oxford and afterwards, Spender had relationships following an affair. This is where you see the confusion of the man's personal life. And at the time, this is life-threatening. He was experimenting with his own gender, his own sensibility, unfortunately. Here, get this. He was invited by the Congress for Cultural Freedom to edit its magazine Encounter. When it was revealed that the CIA was part funding the magazine, it shocked him and he resigned. He taught English both in the States and in the UK, and eventually became a professor of English at University College London from 1971 to 77. He was still writing. We're going to share with you a poem today. This is called The Fates. Now, what did the poet see that we tend to ignore? Just the attention to the detail. Always the attention to the detail. And whether it has meaning, the languages, the words are really... the words of poetry have to keep up with the fluidity of thought, and they don't, you know, our sentences form a convention, but when you put we have to express a thought, it's like mixing oil paint on your palette. The Fates. In the theater, the actors act a ritual of their parts, clowns, killers, lovers, captain, and at the end falling on the sword, which opens out a window through their hearts. And through the darkness of the gleaming eyes of the watching masks, slightly bored of the audience, acting the part of their indifference, pretending the thrusting pistons of the passions, the contorted masks of tears and mockery do not penetrate the surface fashions covering their naked skins. We are not green fools nor black-eyed tragedians, though perhaps in earlier histories we were the killers. Still we have our moments of romance under the moon when we are the lovers, but the rules of fate do not apply to us. The howling consequences can be bribed away, sensibly, without fuss. When we have left the play, no furies of atonement follow after our feet into the street, where the traffic is controlled all day. Sitting in stalls or pit, they pray that the externalized disaster. Not meh. History. We've been talking about that influence of British masonry on the development of masonry on the continent, particularly in the Netherlands, in the provinces. And we've talked most recently about this struggle for independence and independence of lodge and the more coordinated control of a Grand Lodge against a backdrop of nationalism in amongst the Dutch. Today, we have to think, just like us, there are forces at play always. Everything is in motion. Even though we like to take in our even in our minds, take a stereotypic picture so that we can stop and pause and examine and understand, we always know that it's an illusion, because everything around, including the ideas that we hold in our hand to study and examine, are in constant motion. It's a dynamic. So how do we do that? I don't know, except that it is just connecting those series of snippets and looking at that the stereotype is an enhancement. It cuts away what you, the speaker, feels is irrelevant, so that you can bring forward some points that you feel are important. Well, certainly one person might be able to do that, but it's enhanced when you have the experience and viewpoints of millions of people. How do you sort that out? Well, we have ethics to do that and help us. As Daniel Borstein helped us understand the differences between opinion. The Greeks, he didn't invent it. The Greeks didn't invent it. They wrote it down. They talked about it. How do I know that your opinion is the truth? How do I know? Everybody has opinions. We have tastes. We have opinions about everything. How do I distinguish? Well, there are ways, and we have. And part of that is agreement and consensus. And we have some. We start off with some theory, and we prove the theory, and then we develop from that a sense of laws. And then we know that the laws are subject to new information. So is this like, I had a boss once that they claimed, it means you have no idea what you're doing. Yes, he said it out loud. So any of that sense that what we know today might change in the future, well, I think, duh. But for someone to pick that up and think, that means that we really don't know. Well, this is an absolutist that I'm talking to. And an absolute, whether I'm talking to the absolutist or just this cynic, is the conversation worth pursuing? I didn't think so. Here, I only say that as context for the portion of history that we're dealing with here. This quarrelsomeness between the lodges, some lodges being more assertive in their independence, and the effort to try and consolidate has been put on pause because of the larger context. There were wars going on on the continent. French and English were battling, and there was concern that it wouldn't just stay there. The wars didn't just begin over on the continent, over in North America. They had been going on for a long time. The Portuguese, the Spanish, the Dutch, the English, and the French. The concern was that they're going to come back. The war wasn't just going to conclude over there, that it could possibly come back. And think about, this stability, what we have is a semblance of order. And if France were to invade, that would be gone. It would be shattered. So there was concern, and it puts on hold this whole. Then you think about your position quite a bit different, don't you? Your position, your work, your priorities begin to change. As it says here, comparing the situation to the crisis provoked by the danger of French invasion in 1672, there was history. And for people that, this is the part where education does help. It gives you that sense that you might not walk around with the notion of 1672 in mind all the time, but you know it's there. You know it's there when you need it. They were very, very, these were, things were polarized. And then all of a sudden, this is the divisive political atmosphere in which we've heard the names of these guys, Schroeder and Rousset, brought out their edition of Locke. And they were talking about John Locke. For our purposes here, the importance of John Locke to our conversation was his emphasis on three natural rights. Remember, it was only in the 17th century that the English had a civil war, that they had taken the authority of the monarch, the limits of the monarch, as far as they could with Charles I, and then they beheaded the bugger. His divine sense that he was godlike. And then they put in his son, 14 years later, was it? Or more. And Charles II, was he much different? Well, he was toned down still. But Locke was, the ideas that people were working with, this philosopher, John Locke, wrote about natural rights of life, liberty, and property. Now, if you're looking for a reason to push back, that is part of it. The situation we were told in 1755 called for strong and effective national leadership, in effect for constitutional reform, as Orangists such as William Bentinck had long advocated. At precisely the same moment, the promoters of the new versions of Locke, his work was being translated and distorted, emphasis on a more confrontational philosophy. The promoters of the new edition of Locke also reconstituted their Masonic lodge. The acknowledgement here is that you don't have one without the other. As much as we pretend when we say we don't talk about it, we don't communicate, perhaps we should look at what the range of communication is, and to think that we can turn that on or turn that off. No. We can say it. We can make it a rule, but we can't stop it. It's like stopping an idea. We should reflect, as the author says here, on the tone and nature of Locke's magisterial two treatises. It's worth a look. I won't get into that here today, but it's worth a look because it has it helps to clarify what people were rewriting and modernizing their constitution. Although in the 18th century the book was believed to have been a justification for the revolution of 1688, we now know that it was written before it. The text puts great emphasis on the power of legitimate legislative authority, not on order in government, but also on the right of men to form a contract out of which duly constituted authority arises. And it makes me think, we have constitutional authority that we live by, and we also have something higher. Our constitutional authority, like us, is answerable to a moral authority. And it's not, and again, I don't think in terms of the hierarchy, I think in terms of the balance, of the symmetry. We don't have masonry without that symmetry, that balance. How do we achieve that and how do we find it? Well, it takes smarter minds than this. So that's we're still talking about late 17th century English contemporaries that would have understood Republican discourse. And you think what's going on, the conversation in France and the emergence of conversation of 1776, you know, the separation tension. And does tension affect our thinking about compliance, about nationalism, about our, the state of our lodges? You bet. You bet. And does it still? Why wouldn't it? Why wouldn't it? Of course. What to do? I guess that depends on your character, doesn't it? Keith Jarrett will help. Sweet music. Well, thank you for tuning in today. I hope it's been everything that you hoped for and more. You can join us next week if you can. We're going to address this sense of agency, purpose. I keep wrestling with the, you know, dealing with the idea that masonry is something that comes from within. It's not external to your being. And the poetry that I'm going to match with it is from a person who's considered the finest peasant poet, John Clare. And I like him because he started off with very humble beginnings, not too unlike my own. And I like to think that, you know, I've worked very hard for what I've achieved. And this, I like the directness of this poetry, and only he taught himself. I had the advantage of a lot of education and access. He taught himself. So come and join us. You'll see. And thank you again. We'll be back. And in the meantime, I hope you'll commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and include yourself. Give yourself a little something there. Thanks. ¶¶